I am going to tell you a story that a powerful state doesn't want you to know about tens of thousands who have disappeared.
Once they get into the hands of the military, they will be tortured brutally.
It's a story so dangerous to tell that for some, it's meant ending up on a kill list.
She was seen as a dangerous political actor and a threat to Pakistan's security, but she was a local hero.
The Kill List, a 6-part investigative podcast, available now. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
First you hear buzz, like maybe you can hear in the background right now. It sounds like the locals call them mopeds because they sound a bit like food delivery bikes flying through the air. There's one there.
It's a chilling description of a drone attack on Kyiv from yesterday's Globe and Mail podcast, The Decibel. The Globe's senior international correspondent, Mark McKinnon, has been reporting on the war in Ukraine. But as you just heard, the battlefield now sounds like it's right outside his window. Mark McKinnon joins us now from Kyiv. Mark, hello.
Hi, Matt.
I was tucking myself into bed last night, and I think you were being jolted out of your bed at the same time because you tweeted loud again over Kyiv. What has it been like over the last few days and nights in that city?
It's been fairly sleepless. I mean, that is the, I think in the last 6 nights, we've only had one night where there were no Russian attacks overnight. And in addition to that, there was one attack during the day. And it's almost getting to be a bit of a pattern. You can, if your managers sleep well, you can sort of go to bed early-ish. In my case, that'd be sort of 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Not my usual bedtime hours, but try and catch a few hours of sleep before the alarm sound, which usually happens around 2 a.m. And then depending on the type of incoming, whether that's the drones you heard in that clip, which usually take about an hour to reach Kyiv, or cruise missiles, which come a lot faster, then sometime after the siren, you start to hear the explosions. And thankfully, most of those explosions, almost 90% of them, have been successful Ukrainian air defense. Unfortunately, though, as I mentioned in the earlier part there's, you know, even when they shoot something out of the sky successfully, bits of burning metal fall to the ground, and people have died in Kyiv this week.
Tell us about what happened, because yesterday, I guess, the attack in Kyiv was deadly, in part because of that falling debris and the fact that people couldn't seek shelter, right?
Yeah, and this speaks to, you know, Ukraine has been through over the last year, 15 months, an incredible number of air raid sirens. At the start of the conflict, when I was here, every time a siren sounded, everybody went running underground. But by one calculation, the first 365 days of the war, there were more than 1,000 alarms. You can imagine that, you know, humans can get used to anything. So you get used to having air raid sirens in your city at some point, and it becomes something you just tend to ignore. And so a lot of the shelters that were available to Kyiv residents at the start of the war, frankly, it wasn't just this one. There are a lot of shelters in this city that are no longer operating because someone's supposed to show up and turn the key, and they've got a bit blasé about it too. And people have stopped showing up at the shelter. They stopped unlocking them. And so on Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, unfortunately, a young family was running to the local shelter in a district of Eastern Kyiv, and the shelter was locked. And while the husband, the family of three, was running around trying to find someone to open this shelter, a Russian missile was shot out of the air by Ukrainian air defense, and that half of a Russian missile effectively landed on a group of people who were waiting outside the shelter door, and three people died, including a 9-year-old girl.
And so people have told you there's no reason to go to the shelter. When these attacks are unfolding over the last few days, what are people doing?
Well, most of us, frankly, that recording that you played, I made that from my bedroom here at the Globe apartment in Kyiv. And most of us just stay in your apartments. You try and move away from the windows, obviously. The rule of thumb is to put two concrete walls between yourself and the outside of the building. So in many cases, that's a bathroom or a corridor. And that, as imperfect as that is, that feels safer in a lot of ways than running the subway shelters. To be clear, there's a network of subway shelters in Kyiv that are still functioning every night as bomb shelters. But to get there from, for instance, from my apartment means running several minutes under open skies. And you don't know necessarily what's coming in, whether you have those few minutes. And also, not all of us can be jolted awake and immediately start running. It takes a few minutes to sort of get your wits about you, realize, you know, what you're supposed to do, gather maybe a bag of things together. So it feels like you don't have time for that, frankly. And so people tend to just go into the corridors, into the bathtub or whatever feels safest for them. And, but others, often people with young children are trying to sort of stick to a routine. So when the alarm goes, we go into the basement or we go into the shelter. And a lot of it's often families who are caught out in the open sky.
As you understand it, I mean, what's the Russian objective in targeting Kyiv in the way that it is? This is a city that has largely been seen to be safe, relatively, compared to perhaps other parts of the country. What's going on right now? What is Russia trying to do?
It's hard to understand from a sheer sort of economics or mathematical perspective or military strategy perspective, because they are flinging vast amounts of expensive technology, military technology, at Kyiv almost every night these days, and very little of it's getting through to its targets. It's having no impact on the ground in terms of the front lines in eastern and southern Ukraine. So the only sort of background that you can put this against is that the Ukrainian military, for several weeks now, everyone has been anticipating that they're going to launch a major counteroffensive using these new weapons that the Western allies, including Canada, have given to them. Sophisticated tanks, sophisticated rocket launchers. And there's a sense that the Russian offensive in places like the Donbass region has stalled, and now it's Ukraine's turn to try and launch a counterattack. And so that's the context here. Now, what Russia's trying to achieve, whether it's trying to show that if you raise the stakes, we can raise the stakes, whether it intended as some sort of message to Ukraine's allies in the West to sort of hold back Ukraine from trying to retake Russian-occupied territories, it's hard to discern, but that is certainly the background here. Is there's a sense that Ukraine's about to go on the offensive and Russia is upping the ante, not just with these nightly attacks on Kyiv, but also by moving nuclear weapons into neighboring Belarus for the first time since the end of the Cold War.
There's also been these drone attacks on Moscow. What's going on there?
This is a very interesting development, because for the past 15 months, most of Russia, almost all of Russia, has felt very, very far away from the front line. And I lived in Russia for a few years in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and I have friends there and contacts there. And frankly, their lives have been largely unchanged by this war, 800 kilometers away, 1,000 kilometers away. That's, to the far eastern border of Ukraine. These drone attacks, they're obviously, there's an element of revenge. Ukrainians who have been unable to sleep because of the attacks on their country, the attacks on their city, take obvious delight in seeing the same thing happening in Russian cities, especially in Moscow, the heart of Mr. Putin's regime. I think that's very psychological. Again, none of these drones are doing much damage, but it's bringing the war to Moscow, raising the stakes for Mr. Putin, showing that he's not invulnerable, but also making the Russian population hopefully think about this war that they seem to broadly support.
Is that war spreading, do you think? There'd be an attacks on Russia just beyond Ukraine's border as well. So is this, what's going on, do you think?
I think there's an attempt here to, the attacks you mentioned were carried out in the neighboring Belgorod region, which is just across the border from Ukraine's eastern Kharkiv region. And these were carried out by two units of Russian citizens fighting on the Ukrainian side under the control of Ukrainian military intelligence. And so these strikes into Russian territory are meant to, yes, to bring the war onto Russian soil. I also think this may be, and this is speculation, but preparations again for the same counteroffensive that we were just talking about. By showing that the Russian border in places like Belgorod is poorly defended, you're forcing the Russian military to move units around from the front line in eastern and southern Ukraine, where most of the Russian military is deployed, to start defending parts of places like Belgorod that have been sort of poorly defended until now, evidently. That spreads the Russian deployment along the more active front lines even thinner, and perhaps creates an opportunity for this counteroffensive that everyone's expecting.
We'll let you go shortly, but just in the last minute or so that we have, how much is at stake in terms of what happens over the next few weeks and months with that counteroffensive, but also what we've been talking about when it comes to Kyiv and to those drone attacks to Moscow?
There's a sense that this counteroffensive is going to be a very important moment. Obviously, there's there's the military component and how much land, if any, can Ukraine retake? Can they punch a hole in the Russian defenses? And there's the psychological element as well. And just sort of the people here have been through 15 hard months. When a place like Kharkiv or Kherson gets liberated, it lifts spirits. Obviously, it helps the governor president Zelensky's popularity as well. But also there's an element of needing to deliver, to show Ukraine's allies in the West that these weapons that have been supplied are effective, and that the strategy of arming the Ukrainian military works and can lead to Russia being pushed back, can lead to Ukrainian victory. And therefore they should keep doing it, because if the counteroffensive stalls, doesn't work, doesn't happen, then the question becomes, okay, how much, you know, are we feeding a stalemate, and does that make any sense?
And does that impact the morale at home as well in Ukraine?
Absolutely. I mean, people here have, you know, everybody talks about, we'll do this after victory, we'll celebrate after the victory. Everybody's, you know, focused on the idea that this is a winnable war, that Ukraine is winning. It's important to demonstrate domestically as well that this is going in a positive direction. This isn't going to be an endless war. You don't have to contemplate whether you want to live your whole lives, your children's lives, under this, these kind of attacks. There is an endpoint, even if it's not, you know, in 2023, but we're working towards an endpoint. That's obviously very important for people's morale.
Mark, thanks for this. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Matt.
Mark McKinnon is the Globe and Mail's senior international correspondent. He was in Kyiv.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
When Brandon Mitchell was 17 years old, he joined the Canadian Armed Forces in New Brunswick. He was a reservist, but his time in the military just lasted a few years. He'd never gone to a conflict zone or fought in a war. His life took another turn, and he ended up in Europe, living in Sweden as a stonemason. But when Ukraine was invaded by Russia last spring, Brandon felt he had to go and help. And that's where he spent most of the last year, on the front lines in Ukraine. He's on a break now. He's with me in our studio in Toronto. Brandon, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me here today, Matt.
Thanks for being here. Begin at the beginning. Why did you decide to volunteer to go to Ukraine?
Well, the third day of the war, Mr. Zelensky asked for volunteers. By the fifth day of the war, I made a decision. I internalized that I would go and help. I didn't know what I would do. I have no combat experience, but I knew I had to help. I thought, maybe there would be a man in his 70s, maybe if I was lucky enough to live longer than that, that a man incomplete, somebody that would wonder, what could you have done? I'll never ask myself that question.
You decided within a couple of days that you would go.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, people could help in any number of ways. And we've spoken with a lot of people in Ukraine who found themselves helping in various ways.
Yes.
Not all of them are going to the front lines. Why did you feel like that was the thing that you could do? That was the contribution that you could make?
I went there with an open mind of humility. It's very relevant to me. I'm a member of a 12-step program. I'm what you call a recovering addict. I celebrated 11 years clean and sober in Bakhmut in January.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I went there with a complete open mind to help. I learned over years from 26 on. I was a bit of a bad boy before. I learned a lot about community service. Now, doing the right thing for the right reason, I've had to learn that. That wasn't raised into me. That wasn't inherent. I got asked to join a medical battalion, and that was my chance to help.
What did your family and friends say?
My Auntie Jennifer is my mother, and I was very scared to go. I called her up on about the seventh day of the war, eighth day of the war, and I told her that I would go help somehow. And I cried my eyes out, and I told her, and I wanted her to be proud of me. And she told me she was proud of me and everything I'd done in my life. And then I wasn't scared anymore.
So where did you go? Explain how this works. You decide you're going to volunteer. And we met people in Poland who were traveling from all over the world who were going in to fight. They were volunteers as well. Where did you go?
Well, it all started on the internet. I was put into a chat group, an app called Signal, and there was over 150 people there. They talked about going next week, next month, next year, next life. I lived in Sweden, yeah? There was 5 of us that made an agreement to meet each other in Krakow. That was the 14th of March, and we crossed over on the 16th.
Did you know what you were going to do when you crossed the border into Ukraine?
Not at all.
And I mean, I ask you this in part. I said that you were a reservist, but you were only in the military for a few years.
4 years?
Yeah.
I told the boys I went with, combat medics, one was a nurse. They'd been to Afghanistan. They were fresh out of the army. They got offered to join Hospitallers, a combat medical battalion, an unpaid volunteer battalion. They asked me if I wanted to come with them. And compared to them, I was scared I wouldn't stack up. And they said, no, we like you. You're good. And I made the choice to go with them. And we went to Kiev and signed up our battalion.
And so what was the training? Again, you have no experience really in this.
None.
What was the training that you were provided with so that you're not just thrown into a war zone as a medic in an important role, so that you're thrown in with some skills?
During the Battle of Kiev, we lived in a very prominent church called St. Michael's. We lived in the basement there. I was put on a course for about 10 days. They had nothing in English. It was all in Ukrainian. There was an American nurse who's very inspirational to me. Her name's Rebecca. She created an English language syllabus for training for us. For 10 days, I learned everything about tactical medicine, controlling bleeding, controlling airways, to handle a casualty, to transport a casualty. There's different stages of care. I think that was 10, 12 hours a day.
What is it that people who haven't been there don't understand about what you were involved in and what you saw?
Well, it shook a lot of my understandings. There's people there who never chose the military. They never chose this war. There's amazing people. In Ukraine, we don't have the typical person who joins the army. There's people, cosplayers, IT workers. This does not compute with NATO, big, strong man. And they're there too. Do you want to serve or not? Some people ran. Some people stayed.
I mentioned that you spent time on the front lines. You were in Bakhmut.
I've spent 9 months in Donbass, mostly Soledar and Bakhmut.
What was it like being there on the front lines? People know the names of these cities because of the carnage that has unfolded there and what has been left, if anything, of those cities. What was it like to be there?
It's really calm until it's not. Northeast to the town of Soledar, that's the majority of my war in one place. I spent a month in hospital. I got blown up by a Russian minefield.
What do you mean, blown up by a Russian
mine? I drove over two Russian anti-personnel mines to evacuate people out of that town. I've done army evacuations of wounded soldiers to an ambulance or to Bakhmut Hospital, whatever the scenario required. My biggest fear was that when I would get them to the ambulance point and I had to go again, I was scared that I'd get scared, that I wouldn't do the right thing, that I would freeze in fear and I wouldn't drive forward again.
Can you go back to, you said you spent a month in hospital?
Yeah.
What happened? What were the injuries that you suffered in this?
Well, during the day, working on the Russian side of Soledar, driving through, it's quite hectic. It was coming towards nighttime. We were essentially making our last run to get civilians out. We got 9 on the previous run. There was 4 children. My car drove over 2 anti-personnel mines, not vehicle mines. Every glass and component was shattered. I remember a brief sensation of heat, a yellow flame. I didn't know it at the time, but one of the pieces of glass pierced my right eardrum and went in quite far. I've lost most of my hearing in my right ear. I've suffered what I'm told is a traumatic brain injury, and I had a brief period of something called blast lung, where your capillaries will bleed.
How are you doing now?
I do have cognitive decline, and some days were worse than others. I would catch myself slurring my words or walking funny. Eventually, I think it's changed my personality. I'm much shorter with my words. That's what my brain works like now. It can do everything just a little bit slower.
Do you regret at all going?
No, never. Not at all.
Well, you answered that immediately.
Yes. You don't know what I know. You haven't seen the people. I've got friends there, you know.
You said we in Ukraine a few
yes,
times.
Yes, we.
What affection and what tie do you feel for that country and to that country now?
Many people often say to me, I'm so proud a Canadian is over there. I feel represented. I'm not proud to be Canadian. I'm grateful. I'm proud of my friends. I'm proud of my work there. And if somebody wants to be grateful for what we're doing there, that's more appropriate to me. So yeah, I do have a sense of pride. I've seen some things that people shouldn't see. I've seen people do things that they never thought they were capable of doing.
What do you want Canadians to know about this war? It's grinding on.
Yes.
And there does not seem to be any resolution to this, no end to this conflict in sight. for people who are watching this from here, again, knowing what you know, mm-hmm. what do you want us here to know?
I want Canadian people, if they choose to support us, thank you, but certainly don't oppose us. And I might not like everything that our government does or America does, but I would say it's infinitely better than the alternative. And right now, for Canadian money, government policy, certainly America's, it's costing them nothing but money. I can't appeal for the Ukrainian people. I'm not Ukrainian, but they deserve better.
You're going to go back?
Yes, sir. Next month.
And for how long?
I don't know. I didn't go there assuming anything. I'm just going to do the best I can.
Be safe. And I'm glad you're here and glad to have the opportunity to talk to you. Brandon, thank you very much.
It's been an honor. Thank you very much for having me.
Brandon Mitchell is originally from New Brunswick and spent the last year as a medic on the front lines in Ukraine.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.